Welcome to the good, the bad, and the ugly of self-storage, your go-to podcast for mastering the self-storage industry. Join host Michael Cunningham and his son Dylan Cunningham as they share insider knowledge, firsthand experiences, and practical advice. Each episode, they dive into real stories from lucrative deals and strategic renovations to the challenges and pitfalls that await. Whether you're a seasoned operator or new to the industry, learn how to succeed, avoid common traps, and seize great opportunities. Tune in to hear their journey, lessons learned, and secrets to making your storage facility a success. Unlock the potential of self-storage with us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the good, the bad, and the ugly of self-storage. I'm Dylan Cunningham, and as always, today with me is my dad, Mike Cunningham. Today, we're going to be talking about one of the most critical parts of any self-storage facility, the foundation. Without a strong foundation, everything else is at risk. So, Dad, before we get into the details, can you tell us why the foundation is so important in a self-storage facility?
Yeah, Dylan, the foundation is what carries the entire load of the building, ensuring longevity and structural integrity. If you don't do it right from the beginning, you're setting yourself up for expensive problems down the road. But hey, before we dive into this episode, as always, our podcast is for entertainment purposes and intended as a springboard for anyone interested in self-storage or potentially considering building their own self-storage facility. Always consult with professionals that specialize in this type of work before you invest.
All right, let's start with preparation. What needs to be done before forming the foundation?
First, you're going to need to make sure the site is properly graded and compacted. Any weak spots in the soil need to be addressed before laying the foundation. Your engineer should specify the soil compaction requirements, and you'll likely need a geotechnical report and compaction testing prior to pouring the concrete.
Gotcha. So how much base rock is required before pouring the foundation?
Yeah, typically 4 to 6 inches of base rock to create a solid foundation pad.
Gotcha. And does the base rock need to be compacted?
Absolutely. Yeah, so proper compaction is crucial, and most cities will require a compaction test to confirm it meets engineering standards. Not to mention, the better this is done, the less likely you'll have settling and cracking in the future.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on this in our last episode, so go give that a listen if you want to hear some more information about compaction tests and grading and whatnot.
Yeah, so once the site's prepped, Dylan, how do you form the foundation? What size boards do you use? And give us your insight.
Yeah, so most self-storage foundations use either a 2x6 or 2x8 form boards, depending on the slab thickness. You'll need wood or metal stakes to hold these boards in place. In my opinion, one of the most critical aspects of forming the slabs is the roll-up door sill or notch. We make these notches 13.5 inches wide and 1.5 inch deep. So this is a critical part to ensure that no water or any water that comes in contact with the door and building will not be able to get into the actual building. This notch should be designed into the slab and engineered from the beginning with the building layout. This is crucial, and we have seen this missed at our other facilities. If it's not formed correctly, it will create lots of water intrusion issues in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's, if somebody doesn't build self-storage all the time or isn't aware, this is a very critical mistake we see happen where this notch is not built in and there's always water problems inside self-storage units. So, you know, the early on buildings that were built in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, we saw a lot of this. Now it's pretty much mainstream. This is going to be like standard building practice, but still see mistakes to this day where there's not a proper slope even on that lip, and water is still getting into the property.
Exactly, exactly. Let's keep moving forward. Is there a footing around the perimeter?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at least in, you know, the buildings that we're continuing to build in Northern California, there's either a 12 or an 18-inch footing that surrounds the perimeter of the actual slab. And this footing typically requires a number four rebar cage that sets into the footing.
Can you tell us, listeners, you know, a little bit more about number four rebar cage? I'm not quite sure everyone understands what you're saying when you say that.
Yeah. So, all right, we could break that down a little bit. And I don't want to bore the contractors that are out there, but the rebar, it has a numbering system, and so every number represents an eighth of an inch. So number four is half inch rebar. And so if you had a number five rebar, you would have a 5/8 rebar,
gotcha.
So on and so forth.
Gotcha.
And so if you're trying to talk technical with a foundation guy or anybody about rebar, and you understand that numbering system, that'll make you sound a little bit more intelligent when it comes to that. In terms of a cage, cages are basically a series of rebar that's built to create a cage, and it's tied together with rebar tie, and again, just keeping the footing strong. The majority of the weight distribution on the building ends up on the footing of the slab, and so that's why they typically require a deeper footing on the perimeter of the slabs of a self-storage building.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, what about vapor barrier? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so vapor barrier is something that, well, we can get into the details of that, but I would say that most of the time we're using a 10 mil vapor barrier. It's laid on top of the base rock prior to pouring the concrete slab to prevent moisture from wicking up into the building. This is, you know, obviously concrete's porous, and this is going to prevent, you know, corrosion and mold issues. It might not be required by the city or county, you know, just based on what your water table is. But in my opinion, if it's something that you could afford and it's in your budget, it's a really inexpensive way to keep your tenants' valuables dry. You know, obviously concrete is porous, and this ensures minimal moisture coming into the units.
Now, I know you said you used rebar in the footing. Do you use rebar in the slab as well? And if so, how thick is it?
Correct. We do. And so as we just mentioned, the rebar is in the footing in a cage format. And then in the field, typically you're going to use rebar 18 inches on center. And this is going to be a number three or a number four rebar. And some of the cost-saving ways we've been able to value add on our properties when we're doing new construction is figuring these things out. Like, what's making sense? Is it still going to be durable? Can we use different products? They're currently using some fiberglass rebar these days, which is super lightweight, easy to work with. But is it more cost-effective than, you know, the traditional steel rebar? Secondly, there's wire mesh. And, you know, depending on your soil conditions, if you're engineers okay with the specs of it. On this current project we just did, we ended up using wire mesh, and it helped in quite a few ways to be super cost effective. The first is the wire mesh sheets. They come 7 foot by 20 foot. They're a number six gauge wire, so they're really durable. And we set those on adobes, which are the little square concrete blocks to kind of hold it off the ground, so that the concrete can go underneath it. It's encompassed. But this allows for another huge saving. It's not in the fact that the wire mesh is less money, but you're not having all the labor costs of wire tying all of that rebar together in the 18 by 18 inch grates. And then secondly, we don't need a pump truck. We could tailgate then. Now the concrete trucks could drive right onto the slabs, and we tailgate right onto the slabs. So that's a big savings when you're talking about the yardage of concrete that we're pouring on a facility. You know, this particular property we're doing is almost 80,000 square feet, so massive savings there.
Gotcha. Now, I know you mentioned using the adobes to put under the wire mesh. You know, for some of the listeners out there that don't know why you do that, can you explain why the mesh can't just lay flat right on the vapor barrier?
Yeah, obviously it's not going to really be doing anything. You want it to be encompassed in the concrete, kind of in the center of the concrete, and that's what's going to create the strength at that point. And so a lot of times I see contractors, they don't even put the adobes down. They lay it directly on the wire and mesh, and then the finishers, they're coming through and they have these hooks and they're hooking the wire mesh as the concrete's being poured and they're pulling it up. And that's still an option and it should be done even with the adobes there. But it's something that if somebody's being lazy and they're not doing it or keeping their eye on it, that wire mesh is just going to sit on that vapor barrier and it's really a lot of money that's being wasted. It's not even working at that point.
Gotcha. Well, that's great advice.
So I always like to talk about some of the new inventions or technology that we're using. We've seen a lot of these new cordless rebar wire tie guns being used on the job sites. And I know you just worked with a few on this last project. Do you think they make a difference in the efficiency, Dylan?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really cool the first time I actually got to try one of these new tools. You know, these save a ton of time and reduce hand fatigue compared to manually tying, you know, each section together. It seems like they also create consistent ties as well, which improves the structural integrity of whatever you're tying together. There are a few YouTube videos out there that show one guy with a wire tie gun against three guys tying by hand, and the guy with the wire tie gun wins. So I would highly recommend this tool. We use the Max brand, and it's a workhorse. I mean, this is the tool you want to be using at your job site.
Yeah, the battery life on that thing seemed to just go on and on and on, and everybody was fighting for that gun. We ended up buying two on this last project.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, even if it messes up, sometimes, you know, you just pull the trigger again, it cuts the wire itself, and just, you know, you're right back onto your project.
All right, so when building the footing rebar cages, do you prefer to use pre-bent stirrups or bend your own at the site? And what's the best method of assembling these cages?
Oh, I definitely prefer pre-bent stirrups. For many reasons. I mean, one, because they speed up the entire process and assure uniform spacing. I would say the best method for building footing cages is to set up some sawhorses so you're not bent over and ruining your back, and create a bit of kind of like an assembly line and, you know, build 90% of the cages in advance before placing them in the footing trench. This is just, you know, so efficient, and you know it's going to create a bunch of consistency.
Yeah, the thing with building self-storage is that it's a lot of repetitive jobs over and over again, and creating efficiencies is really the name of the game. You're always going to have a learning curve on the first building, the first pad, the first of each thing. But then as you do that and you figure out where your inefficiencies are, you start to get some critical mass. Totally. And it really is amazing. On this particular project, our first building was about 2.5 weeks, and now we're doing them in about a week. And so talk about, you know, killing the production. It's just been awesome. So anyway, let's move on to concrete. What's the typical PSI of the concrete used for a self-storage foundation, Dylan?
Yeah, so we typically use around 2,500 to 3,500 PSI concrete to, again, ensure durability and longevity.
Perfect. Who ensures the concrete proper PSI?
Yeah, so the PSI is the pounds per square inch, and it measures the compressive strength of concrete. It's, you know, it's a way to determine how much pressure concrete can withstand before it starts to crack or fail. So special inspections have definitely become a very important part of most construction projects in California. As for the PSI, typically your engineering firm will be contracted from, you know, the beginning of the project to conduct all of the special inspections, including continuous or periodic sample tests while you're pouring concrete as well. In our experience on single-story self-storage buildings, periodic testing is usually the norm.
Yeah, so special inspections, maybe we can dive into that just a little bit. I know it's a little off topic, but I think it's important that people understand that most of the municipalities, whether it's county or city across California, want to take the liability of a lot of these inspections off their in-house inspectors, and they actually have us contract with the engineering firms to do these on-site special inspections. And so typically you'll sign a contract from the beginning with a engineering firm, typically the engineering firm that did your civil work, and it's going to have each of the items that are going to be outlined by the city that they're going to want special inspected. And that in this project we're talking about here was for compaction testing. They'll do PSI testing on the concrete. If you're doing any foundational bolts that need to be epoxied in, they might ask for an on-site inspector while that's happening. And so you use some verbiage like periodic
continuous.
And continuous. And so continuous would be, they want somebody there inspecting every yard of concrete that hits the ground. And that's typically not the case in a single-story self-storage building. Mm. They're going to want periodic testing.
Gotcha.
So anyway, I think that was nice for some of the listeners that might not understand. This is a very important, and it's something that it's a financial impact on the project. You got to pay the engineers to come out and do this. They're obviously not cheap. It's by the hour. They're usually charging drive time. If they're doing samples for concrete, they'll leave the samples there to cure and then come back and pick them up. And that's all you're going to see, all those line items on your bill. Oh, another trip to pick up the samples. So anyway,
Nothing cheap these days.
Yeah, this is stuff that hopefully you can negotiate in the beginning, whether it needs to be periodic or continuous. And so just FYI.
Gotcha. Well, that's great advice. Let's move on to, you know, finishing the concrete. What do you think about powerscretes? Do you recommend them?
Absolutely. For a project, these self-storage facilities with, you know, the large amount of square footage that you're building, you don't want to be screeting all this stuff by hand. It's just not recommended, especially when you get into the wider slabs. But powerscretes help create a smooth and level surface much faster than hand screeding, especially for, as I mentioned, these big, large slabs. We do not do our concrete finishing in-house, and I would suggest for those large project that your finisher uses powerscretes. It'll give you a much smoother, even slab. You know, so 25 feet is kind of the sweet spot, and the minute you get over that, there's screets. They're not going that long, and that's where you really need a powerscrete.
Right.
So anyway, these are questions to ask your finishers when you're out there getting bids. You know, do they use a powerscrete?
Gotcha. What about expansion joints? Are those necessary? And if so, how do you install them?
Yeah, so necessary, most of the time required, at a minimum of 10 foot. So every 10 foot, you're gonna put an expansion joint. And so this allows for movement due to temperature changes and settling. We usually saw cut ours in the slabs every 10 foot, and we use it's a Husqvarna. It's called a soft cut power saw, and it's really designed to be cut as soon as you're comfortably able to walk on the slab while the concrete is not fully cured. It's still fairly soft, and you're not burning through the blades, and you're able to cut this really easy.
Interesting. What type of finish is used on the concrete, and do you recommend power troughs for finishing the concrete?
Yeah, so a smooth finish is always, you know, going to be what you're going to put on a self-storage building slab. It's going to be something that's going to be easily swept and cleaned. And you're typically going to achieve this using power trowels. Again, you're talking about big surfaces, and to trowel this all by hand would just be too labor intensive. So we always use power trowels. Again, these are questions you're going to want to talk to your finishers about from the beginning to make sure that they have this type of equipment to get the best achieved results at the end and most cost effective.
Gotcha. As always, you know, we like to, you know, share any good, bad, or ugly stories. So I was wondering if you had any worth sharing today.
On this particular project, we were building our slabs, and we're right on the freeway, and full exposure. And OSHA was driving down the freeway and saw that there was a few stakes that did not have the orange caps on it. And so he made a U-turn, came back off the freeway, and he came in, I would say, guns a-blazing, not happy about the situation. And it was frustrating because we were just putting these stakes in, and we hadn't got back to these stakes yet to put the caps on it. And he didn't think that that was a good enough answer. He wanted to make sure that for every stake that went in, there was a box of caps sitting right next to us. And the minute the stake went in, a cap went on it. And so, we went through a process. You know, that opens the door at that point. Then they kind of have full reign to do a full investigation on your job site to make sure that you're compliant. And, you know, thankfully we were. There's lots of compliancy in California in terms of a safe workspace, and we were complying in all aspects of that. But unfortunately, you know, we're fully exposed on the freeway. It wasn't like somebody called on us, or he was just doing a, you know, kind of a impromptu visit on us. He was just driving by and looked over and saw that. And he's got to have some good eyesight too. I don't even know how he saw that.
That's brutal.
In any case, I would say that was a bad. We were fined. We still have not paid that fine. We are in the midst of a. You have the opportunity to go into kind of a, like a.
Like an appeal,
yeah,
right?
Like an appeal process. And so we went into an appeal process just to kind of say, hey, we've never had any fines in the past. We've always been compliant. This was a first offense. It was a very minimal. The stakes were only out of the ground, like 6 inches, 8 inches tops. And so we're hopeful that we'll be able to reduce the fine, you know, just based on the appeal.
Gotcha. All right. Well, we covered a lot today, from prepping the site, forming the foundation, reinforcing it, pouring the concrete, and finishing the slab. What's your biggest piece of advice for someone new to self-storage development?
I'd say don't skimp on base rock. Make sure that you do a really good job on the compaction and plenty of base rock. I mean, these two things are going to ensure that you have minimal cracks and settling on your slabs. And then lastly, I would make sure you discuss with your engineer early on to see if you could use wire mesh over rebar grids. We saved a tremendous amount of money on this particular process or project with the wire mesh rather than 18-inch by 18-inch rebar wire grids. So those, I think, are the two big differences at this stage of the construction. So... great compaction, don't cheap out on the base rock, and talk to your engineer potentially about using wire mesh.
Gotcha. Well, that's it for episode 4, guys, of the good,
the bad,
and the ugly of self-storage. Next time, we'll be diving into underground utilities and finished grading, what you need to know. One last thing, if you write us a review on the platform you listen from and send it to us at info@selfstoragebrokeragegroup.com, we will send you our must-have, the 50 money-saving questions to ask the professionals if you're thinking about building a self-storage facility. Thanks again for tuning in. Don't forget to like and subscribe.
Thanks for tuning in to the good, the bad, and the ugly of self-storage. We hope you found today's episode valuable. If you enjoyed the podcast, please like us, leave a review, and share it with others. For more tips and updates, follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You can also listen to us on your favorite podcast app. Until next time, let's unlock the potential of self-storage together.